It's kind of a balance, you know, like there are definitely moments in episodes where you know, okay, we're going to use a bigger name artist, or the director's really attached to this specific song that's going to cost us like 40 grand, which means we've got to use indies or baby artists, or, you know, do more of a blend between the episode, within the episode, and probably within the season, which I like doing better. I think it's more interesting. I think it's boring to just use music that everybody knows and has heard a million times.
This episode is brought to you by BandZoogle. This is how you should be creating your website. I've made many websites on BandZoogle for years. Long before they were paying me to tell you about it, I told everyone about it because it's super, super easy. Don't mess around with web developers. Let me tell you. The most frustrating people on planet Earth are web developers. No offense to my brother, who is a web developer. He's amazing. He was the one who originally built ariestake.com. You're awesome, Mika. Hey, what up? Okay. But they're frustrating. They're always overworked. They take on too many projects. They're always getting sniped by startups that will pay them way more than any independent musician can pay them. So you should not be messing around with web developers. Stop paying web developers. Seriously. You know this by now if you have been hiring web developers for your websites. You can't get a hold of them. You can't afford them. And they are just, the turnaround times are way too long. So, BandZoogle, this is how you can build a website. It's super easy. They also have a built-in store, commission-free. You can sell music. You can sell downloads, PDFs, whatever you want to sell. It's all commission-free. They have a crowdfunding service. This is new. That's also commission-free. They also have a subscription service on there if you want to kind of start your own fan club and have subscribers, fans, patrons, whatever you want to call them, commission-free. This is all at BandZoogle.com. You can get a 30-day free trial if you use the code ARI, that's my name, and you also get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Go to BandZoogle.com, use the promo code ARI, that's just spelled A-R-I, for 15% off the first year of any subscription. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Third edition is out now in all formats, audiobook, hardcover, ebook, however you like to consume books, you can find the book anywhere. Today, my guest is Brittany Duje. She is a music supervisor, and she has worked on projects like From Scratch on Netflix or Hulu's Life and Beth, which we spend a bit of time talking about today. Season 2 just came out. Amazon's A League of Their Own and Daisy Jones and the Six, along with a few films. And we kind of dig into all things sync licensing today, music supervising, all of that. So whether you're an artist or a manager or an indie label or a publisher or someone who's interested in getting your music placed in TV shows, or you're someone who's actually interested in becoming a music supervisor, we talk all about that today. We talk about what TV shows are paying, kind of some of the budgets that you're looking at, how this all works, you know, how music supervision actually works. So if you want to know a little bit of behind the scenes of how songs get placed in TV shows, Brittany really steps you through all of this, you know, kind of from start to finish, and just kind of how the whole process works. It was a really informative conversation. I really enjoyed and appreciated Brittany's transparency and everything she brought. I do want to give a shout out. If you are interested in sync licensing, check out Ari's Take Academy. We have a course on sync licensing taught by arguably one of the most successful artists in the sync space, Vo Williams. He's had over 3,000 placements, sync placements of his own music. He's the instructor for this course. And we've helped get around 200 of our students signed with sync agents. And Brittany will talk a little bit more throughout the episode of how and why she appreciates and works with sync agents. So if you're interested, go check out ariestakeacademy.com and check out the sync licensing course. You can find Brittany on IMDb. Just search her name, Brittany Duje. That's spelled D-O-U-Z-I-C-H. You can also visit brittanyduje.com or find her on Instagram. You can find all of us that make the show happen at Ari's Take on Instagram, TikTok, X, and Threads. You can find me at Ari Herstand on Instagram. And visit ariestake.com and get on the email list. That is where we're going to send the most up-to-date relevant info about the new music business. That's how you can stay in touch. But right now, if you could just pause this episode, leave us a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or however you're listening to this. If you're on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, leave us a comment, and click the follow or subscribe button if you want these episodes and the show to continue in your feed. All right, let's kick into the show. Brittany Duje, welcome to the show.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm excited for this conversation because sync licensing is one of the most popular topics for this audience, for the new music business audience, and for just kind of musicians, indie artists in general. They hear, like, you know, how lucrative it can be, and they hear how life-changing it possibly can be. They hear about the stories of artists, you know, blowing up from various sync placements or something like that. And we've had various music supervisors on the show. But I, for people that aren't familiar with sync licensing or music supervision, I would love for you to just explain, from your perspective, just help people understand what you do. What is a music supervisor, and what does a music supervisor do?
Oh, that's such a big question, and I love answering it. We do so many different things, and it really depends on the type of project that it is. You know, sometimes it's just consulting and saying, hey, you got to license this song. Somebody owns it. You can't just fair use everything in a documentary film. It's something like a low lift like that, you know, to helping source composer options and working with them to create like a sound palette for a project. It's also selecting music that could fit within a scene for a film or a TV show. And then, you know, figuring out who owns the rights, negotiating the rates and the terms. And sometimes that takes a ton of research to figure out who represents those musicians. And, you know, putting together creative ideas, doing on-camera work, if there's original music, an original song, like sourcing artists, maybe booking, you know, studio space, creating songwriter camps for original music. It can be a pretty heavy lift, and the, you know, specific functions vary based on what the project needs.
You had me for everything up until you mentioned songwriter camps. I was under the impression that songwriter camps was primarily kind of a music publisher's job, or sometimes sync agencies will put together songwriter camps. Where do music supervisors fall into this songwriter camp realm, and what is your involvement with? I mean, are you organizing them? Are you kind of attending them to help with the songwriters, bringing briefs to the camps? Tell me more about that, because I've never heard a music supervisor talk about a songwriter camp before.
So I would say that's usually only the case on a like very music heavy show, like on Daisy Jones and the Six, Frankie Pine, who was like the music supervisor on that. She did a writer camp but it was just with, you know, like a very specific group of writers writing for the show, writing for the original music. So in that case, you know, like we're heavily involved in that. We're going to those sessions. We're selecting who's a part of that, helping to craft the song and kind of teach people how to be a band sometimes.
Were you doing that? You're teaching them how to hold a microphone and all of that, and how to work with the music.
Yeah, be real cool like this is how you do
it. Right cool. Okay, no, that makes a lot of sense, because Daisy Jones and the Six was so music focused. For those that are not familiar, the show is about a fictional band in the 70s, and with all original music for that band. And I know if I'm not mistaken, I think Blake Mills was a big part of that, kind of co-writing and producing a bit. Blake Mills is a producer for Alabama Shakes, and he's in Fearless Flyers and stuff like that. So very cool. So but kind of to the for shows that aren't as music centric, I guess, or shows that aren't about a fictional band with original music, because that's I think that's more of an anomaly. Let's talk more about let's start with the fun part of the job of kind of choosing the music. How does that process work? When let's first talk about a TV show, and you know, just kind of step me through when you come into the process and what those conversations are like and how you choose the music. Is like the director or the writer saying, these are the songs we want, or do they say, hey, where do we put music? And then you come in and be like, oh, I think music would actually fit over this scene, or something. Like, kind of step me through the whole process of how that works.
Yeah, it's kind of a mix, you know, like sometimes things are written into the script, and sometimes those things are like not realistic gets, you know, like the Beatles or something like that.
Sure.
And that's, you know, where we come in. But we also do script spotting, which is basically like reading through a script and flagging moments that we think music would naturally be, like source music on the radio or in a car. But also, cool. You know, where we think there could be like a highlighted musical spot that could just add emotion to a scene. So there's a little bit of that. And there's also, you know, talking with a showrunner, director, to kind of get a sense of what their vibe is for each scene. Mm. Like, do you want music here? This is what I think could work. What are you thinking? There's, you know, definitely like a good collaborative conversation. Ideally, there is. You know, not always the case, but
sure.
That's generally what happens. And then, you know, we work really closely with editors too. And they sometimes have a very big say in what gets chosen or what they think the appropriate vibe is for a show or a specific scene. So, you know, you've got to be flexible and I would say kind of like take your ego out of the process to a degree. Like it's whatever best serves the project. And like ultimately, I can think something is amazing, but if it doesn't fit with the creative vision of whoever's running the show, like I've got to, you know, function within those parameters. So it can be tricky.
When you come into a project, like a TV show, let's say you come in kind of at the very beginning, early on, are you kind of part of, you know, before the show airs, are you part of kind of helping create a sonic palette, for instance, of the show, or how does that work?
Ideally, yeah. I think most of the time people are really open to that, you know? I think people come in with a very loose sense, or music's really honestly just an afterthought. So generally people love talking about music or to have some kind of guidance. So it's nice to be somebody that people can lean on, you know, or and you can kind of help guide them to what makes sense, you know, creatively and budget, you know.
Yeah, I'm curious these days kind of where a lot of these TV shows are in terms of the types of music they place, and if there is even a sonic palette. Like, for instance, just to expand a little bit on what I mean by sonic palette, my first big sync placement was about 12 years ago in the TV show One Tree Hill. I had never seen the show. Lindsay Wolfington was the music supervisor. I'd never seen the show. People were watching the show and said, hey, Ari, this show uses a lot of singer-songwriters, music that sounds like you. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that TV shows did that, like used very similar music. I had no idea what was going on at the time. And I just was like, oh, well, let me see how I can get my song on the show. And in the end, I ended up tweeting a song to Lindsay Wolfington, and she ended up placing the song. I mean, this doesn't happen anymore. And we've since talked about this. She came on the show as well. She's like, wow, I think you're probably the only one I've ever placed from a tweet. But you know, like that show had a very distinct sonic palette, and you know, Empire has a very distinct sonic palette that was not, you know, hip hop and One Tree Hill is more singer-songwriter. And there are those shows, there are certain shows that have that. Whereas, for instance, like, you know, Euphoria, for instance, we had Jen Malone on the show as well. In one episode, there'll be a hip-hop song and a country song and, like, an Americana roots folk song back to back to back. And you're like, wow, this is all over the place. I'm curious from your perspective these days, where are you seeing the trends? Are shows kind of working with that kind of a distinct kind of sonic palette theme? Or is it kind of like, let's just place hip, trendy, interesting music? Or, yeah, step me through that process and where we're at.
Well, that's a tough one. I think there's definitely a trend of shows who try to be solid like that and have consistency among, you know, between episodes or within the episode of a sonic palette. I think that's really cool. But I would say it takes a lot of dedication from whoever's directing or show running to be mindful of that. And this is the intention I want and how I'm going to carry it through every episode. I don't know if that's as important to other shows or as essential, to be honest. You know, I think most shows jump around and it kind of just, you know, it's whatever fits the scene. And also, like, I was going to mention all the CW shows, including One Tree Hill, they all follow very similar sonic roadmaps of that, like, singer-songwriter, you know?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So when artists like that hit me up, I'm like, you know where to go first.
Yeah. is that still happening over there? I don't know. I've kind of stopped paying attention. But yeah, cool.
You know, I'm not like the biggest CW viewer, I would say. Probably not my demo, but... yeah, I think that's still a solid selection.
Cool. Good to know. Good to know. Maybe I'll pitch a few more songs over there, figure out which shows are happening. Yeah. okay, cool. So kind of going back into that process of when you come in and how that works. You said you kind of will work with the editor. You might work closely with an editor. Talk to me about the difference between music that you license, you place, and you're kind of in charge of versus, you know, what the composer is in charge of. And if you could just kind of explain a little bit and distinguish between kind of the score, the music on a TV show that comes from the composer versus the music on a TV show that comes from you and other artists.
Yeah. So, I mean, the music that a supervisor places, it's usually from an artist or a band. Mm-hmm. We're usually dealing with a label and a publisher. It's something that's like a source cue or it's a featured musical moment where there are lyrics, usually, not always. And it's, yeah.
What does a source cue mean?
So a source cue is something that's like playing on the radio or if somebody's at a restaurant, you know, it's in the background. It's like something you would naturally hear in the real world. But score, you know, is generally used to support a scene or just, you know, bring emotion to a moment without calling attention to lyrics. It's more like a little support.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
And are there like, what part of the process do you come in, you know, for a TV show? And when does your work begin?
the earlier the better. I also worked in house at a TV for a TV production company, so I was brought in, like, you know, to budget for pre-production, which was amazing.
Oh wow!
To see every stage, but when you're working as a freelancer, you usually don't get brought in really until post. Maybe right before post starts, depending on the show. I mean, if there's live musical performances, then yeah, you get brought on for pre-production or production to kind of, you know, find music to clear for that or, you know, find a band that's going to be performing live. So,
yeah. Got it. So, typically if there's not a band in the show, you said you're brought in for post. That means after the show is shot and I'm right. assuming edited maybe, or what is, explain, we're talking to music people here. Talk to me, what does post mean?
Right. I forget.
We're not in film. We don't do TV. Yeah. Post is like mixing and mastering if we're talking to musicians, but in film and TV, it means something very
different. That's way too late.
Yeah.
Film
right.
TV.
Okay. Yeah. What are you talking about?
So post is basically like once we've gotten all the footage back from production when they're shooting and okay. it starts going to the editing team. And usually people like me get involved before they have, any scenes cut together. So that way we can have discussions about, you know, what direction they're thinking for music. I can start to put together ideas and potentially build bins for the editing team. So that way, while they're trying to cut together scenes, they can pull from music that I've already given them. And, you know, we can flesh out what's working, what's not working, where we've got to swap stuff, you know. Massage
Can
things.
You tell, what does a bin yeah. mean? You said he put together bins.
I mean, a folder.
I'm going to be asking a lot of like, what does that mean that you said? You're throwing a lot of lingo around, which That's is sorry. Great, but because you do this day in, day out, and this is awesome yeah. because everyone here is loving to learn. I love to learn. I'm gonna ask you, I'm going to be really annoying and ask you every time
it.
You throw out a word that I don't know what it means. Because I'm not in that realm. So talk to me about bin. When you say you put together a bin, what does that mean?
It's basically, folders of genres of music or moods of music based on whatever discussions we have or whatever I think the musical direction should be in a project. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they ingest those into whatever editing program they're working with.
Mm.
So, okay. Yeah.
Cool. So you put together a folder of music that you think would fit. Now, when you put together this, and you send in songs or music or something like that, mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier there are some source cues. Here we go. I'm going to throw that lingo right back at you. I'm going to do my best here to try to work with the lingo that we've learned so far. I feel like I'm in class. There are some source cues like where, you know, something's on the radio. So you're like, okay, we know that this is going to be when the person turns the dial, they're driving in a car on mm-hmm. the radio, a song starts playing. Now, do you just give them a folder of like, here's 20 songs that I think would be great for this episode? Or are you like, all right, this song or these maybe three songs I think could fit for when they turn the radio on that source cue. And then like these five songs might be good for the ending credits, or step me through a little bit more specifically of how this process works when you actually have a batch of song, a bin of songs that you want to send through.
So I would say usually when the show's first entering the editing phase, if we do mm-hmm. put together bins or folders of music, it's kind of really broad. And then once we get into working with specific scenes, that's when I give them much more limited options. So yeah, it's maybe like 3 to 6 options for a specific scene that I think could work, that fit within the budget. And then, yeah, it is a breakdown. Like, okay, this could work for a car driving by. Or, you know, this could work for the end credits. Or here's music for all the scenes that are based in the 90s. You know, something like that. So.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned budget. let's talk what that means when you say budget. First off, what do you mean when you say works within the budget? What does that mean?
Like on a show, we usually get an episodic budget. So there's, you know, $100,000 per episode that we're allotted. Okay. And, you know, there's wiggle room. You can like, if you spend less in one episode, you can spend a little bit more mm-hmm. in another. Cool. Hopefully we get more money and then we can pay artists better. But, you know, mm-hmm. so that's kind of the breakdown for TV. We have like a set budget that usually is a freelance music supervisor. You don't have much of a say in. It's kind of, you get it. And that's, it is what it is. But
and for, so you have, let's just, as an example, you used $100,000 per episode, and this is just for the upfront sync license fees that you would pay, and we're talking, you have a total of $100,000, and you have to essentially be able to license all of the songs for that episode with that $100K, right?
Yeah, both the recording side and the publishing side. Yeah, yeah.
Right, and for people that aren't familiar exactly with how licensing and sync rights work, I'll just briefly explain it. When you said the recording side and the publishing side, there's two copyrights to every recording. There's the recording copyright and the publishing, the composition copyright. Some people call this the music work. And basically, the composition is all the people who wrote the song. They all have publishers. You have to kind of clear it because they have to give you permission. And then the recording side is usually a record label or an artist themselves, if they don't work with a record label, that also have to give you permission. You know, for some songs, there's, I mean, especially some pop songs, there could be 10, 12 songwriters. And so that can be like 10 or 12 different publishing companies and a record label. And so if you have $100,000, you know, talk to me about the kinds of music you're able to place, because my understanding was probably a lot of major labels and major publishers are not going to be going, if there's 10 songs, I'm just as an example, if there's 10 songs an episode and each song you could theoretically kick $10,000 to, you know, all in for the publishing side and the master side, you know, do majors go for that? Is that pretty reasonable? Is like that what most people are doing, or do you like working with indie artists that would be thrilled to get $10,000 for their song in a TV show? Or talk to me about that process a little bit.
It's kind of a balance, you know. Like there are definitely moments in episodes where you know, okay, we're going to use a bigger name artist, or the director is really attached to this specific song that's going to cost us like $40,000, which means we've got to use indies or baby artists, or, you know, do more of a blend between the episode, within the episode, and probably within the season, which I like doing better. I think it's more interesting. I think it's boring to just use music that everybody knows and has heard a million times. Sure. And, you know, who doesn't love championing artists and exposing them to a new audience, you know?
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder. And yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative. And they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out TooLost. You can just go to TooLost.com, use the promo code ARISTAKE for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. Awesome. So give me a range, I guess, typically what you're seeing on TV shows of, you know, because most of the people listening are indie. They're not with a major publisher, major label that are negotiating this on their behalf. And I think a lot of artists listening or managers listening would be interested to know, what are the ranges that you're seeing that you're able to offer to indie artists for a TV show sync placement all in?
It also depends on, you know, where the show is airing. You know, that if it's a smaller network, their budgets are going to be crappy. You know, okay. If you're on a major network, you, as an artist, you should kind of have a sense like, okay, maybe I can negotiate up a little bit because their budget's probably higher on a major network show. It's not always the case, but I would say it can't hurt to ask for a bump if you're an indie. I've seen fee ranges between, you know, $2,500 to $15,000 for an indie artist. It just really depends. Yeah.
Sure. What is, here I go asking you to define terms a little bit more. What does major network mean these days? Like was Netflix considered a major network? I know that's like a studio, cause the terms, everything is so blurred right now with streaming. It's like, I would know, if we were talking 20 years ago, like, oh, NBC is a major network and CW's cable. But like, I don't know what that means anymore. Is Netflix on the higher end and like, ESPN on the lower? I don't really have kind of, just kind of break that down a little bit.
That's a good question. Even as I was saying that, I was like, wait, there's all this variation in streaming. Like, how does that even make sense anymore? It's tricky because, you know, Netflix ranges too. Sometimes their budgets are larger on specific projects and smaller on others. Or if it's a project that an outside company is making and Netflix is just acquiring the rights to it, that affects the budget. Sure. And there's definitely a difference between streamers. I would say, you know, like if you're streaming something from HBO, their budget's probably going to be better than like, you know, like who can I say that's okay for me to
Peacock? Just or like Paramount. Sure. Right. Paramount, I guess, is another one. Well, let's talk Hulu for a bit, because I know you worked on, Life and Beth, which is Amy Schumer's show and Michael Cera. And how is that, not necessarily with the budgets, but I'm curious, you know, kind of how that process works. Specifically, I watched, I just got back from New Orleans. I was there for Mardi Gras a couple weeks ago. I love New Orleans. I try to spend as much possible time there. I go there every 3 years to write the new edition of my book. And then I'm just like, I have family that lives there. So I just like love the city. So I watched in season two, I believe it was episode two of Life and Beth, the New Orleans episode, which was really fun. And I saw some friends with that. I saw Ben Jaffe at Preservation Hall, jazz band. And like, it was cool because there was a lot of live music. And you know, and this is, I'm one of the very few people that probably realize this, but I have the Preservation Hall jazz band record on vinyl, the That's It album, and so I know it very, very well. And as I'm watching the show, I'm like, this isn't the recording from the album. Yeah. This actually sounds live. Talk to me about the process of when you're doing a TV show like that, where you're using real musicians, live music. How maybe step me through that episode and how that worked.
That episode, I mean, those two episodes in New Orleans were kind of crazy. We had to scramble to clear everything and figure out what songs people were going to perform, like, over the holidays when everything was shut down and no one was answering emails. And then we had like 3 weeks before we went to shoot, and we were still trying to figure out which Jimmy Buffett song he was going to play and if he was going to fly in for the episode. There was just a lot. But with the Preservation Hall, I know like there were a lot of concerns because we were like, should we just clear the backing, the original, just in case the sound doesn't turn out right? And how is that going to blend with the audio within the scene? Are we going to have to shoot this dry, or, you know, like with no music, so that way we can just get the actors and then cut the music in later? We're all really nervous, but I mean, obviously the sound, if you've been to Preservation Hall, like, it's great. Everything was mic'd appropriately and it sounded fantastic. And they were so nice and performed so many takes of that song. It was definitely like one of my career highlights to be there. So, yeah.
Oh, I bet. I mean, that place is so historic. And I loved, I mean, this is a little, I'm gonna diverge a little bit, but I loved that Ben Jaffe, who's in Preservation Hall, he's the sousaphone player, the tuba player, but he's actually, I believe, the founder of Preservation Hall Jazz Band. His parents owned the club, and he actually they wrote in a part of their story. Like, he actually did grow up in Preservation Hall, and that was like he was kind of taught, and they used his real name in it, and so it was cool, kind of blending the reality with the fantasy in that episode a bit.
It was
super cool. Real musicians. It was the real Pres Hall. Charlie Gabriel is in it, and who's like 91 years old these days. And it was very cool. And then so when you do something like that, I want to get back to kind of the rights and stuff. I'm curious because there's the publishing doesn't change because whoever wrote the song, whether it's being performed live or on the record or whatever. So you'd clear from the publishing company or those that wrote it. And then when it's live, how does that work? Who are you clearing the rights for a live recording from?
I mean, technically nobody. Like, it kind of counts, or it can count as a new recording that's, you know, being done by the production.
So they own it.
I'm sure there's circumstances where, you know, somebody's connected to a label or something, and they probably have to discuss who's going to own portions of the, you know, the recording or the new recording. But in our case, we didn't have to do that.
Gotcha. Yeah. They're indie, and there's no like probably re-recording clauses in their own independent contract that, you know, they don't have to do a Taylor's version. Right.
Yeah. Ben owns the publishing rights. So it was very, very easy.
Yeah. It's very easy. That's cool. Nice. So, okay, that makes sense. And I'm assuming for Daisy Jones and the Six, nothing was performed live. It didn't seem that way. It seemed like they were all lip syncing to everything.
Yeah, I don't remember. I kind of got brought in when we were like, right when they finished shooting and we were moving into the editing phase. I'm not exactly sure. I feel like they didn't perform live, but honestly, Stephanie might know.
No, they didn't. I could just tell by as a musician watching it. I mean, it was unless they like, I mean, you know, little a cappella things here and there, but it was very polished. I'll say. And so it sounded like they probably did it, and unless they added a lot of Melodyne and in post and everything from the live stuff, but it was. But anyway, talk to me about the. I know there was. Now I'm blanking on. I didn't write it down what the show was, but the Norah Jones Hank Williams song that.
Oh yeah, that was in Life and Beth.
Oh, that wasn't Life. Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That was later in the season. So talk to me about that, because I noticed that the recording that was over the end credits of this Norah Jones recording of this Hank Williams song, it wasn't the actual recording from the record. However, she wasn't playing it live in the show. It was like it. So did she record it specifically for the show? And if so, why, when you could have just used the recording of it?
She did record it specifically for the show, kind of. I'm not going to say by accident, because it was intentional, but we kind of didn't have another choice. We tried to clear the rights for the original, and no one knew who owned the rights. It was
of the
bizarre.
Recording?
Of the master recording. Yeah.
It says Sony Music on Spotify for that Hank Williams tribute album, but maybe is that not accurate?
No. Because
they just distributed it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. And it's like part of it was released from Bob Dylan's imprint. I think it's called Egyptian. And so
under Sony, that makes
that
sense.
Falls under uh-huh. Sony. We hit up mm-hmm. both of them and they were like, turns out no one included sync language in the original agreement. So that was tied to the recording. And we were like, are you guys serious? How could you release an album without, this is 2011, I think, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Film, TV, music is not that young.
Right.
So luckily she was already in the studio and Egyptian was just like, you know, have her do a new master. She did it super quickly and we were able to just clear that. But it was a long road to get to that point. We thought we were going to have to pull the track out. You know, we went through so many rounds of options, but that was the song that everybody thought fit the best. And it kind of worked out in the end, but it was a hot mess for a minute.
It sounds great. And, you know, she's such a pro. That's cool. I want to transition a little bit into, you know, there's a lot of artists that are listening right now and they want to get their music on TV shows, in film, you know, that they want to get synced. What is your recommendation? How would you encourage artists to kind of go about this? Do you work with artists directly? Should artists, you know, hit you up and be like, hey, place my music, or like, so talk to artists for a second of just like your recommendation of how they should go about this.
Oh, that's a big question. I try to tell artists to, you know, listen to what's being placed in film and TV and kind of get a sense of where their music makes the most sense and what genres that are being placed do they kind of identify with, and create music for sync based on that, because that's probably going to be what's going to get you most likely to be placed ultimately. You know, it's a combination of networking, hardcore networking. I would say it's music placements, a lot of who you know. If you're able to connect with supervisors, that's great. If you're able to work with the publishing company or somebody who pitches music to music supervisors, mm-hmm. like a sync pitcher, mm-hmm. who maybe you fill a niche that they don't have. You know, you don't want to be like lost in a sea of people who all sound like you at the same sync pitcher. Like, that's going to be so hard to break through. But, you know, you got to do your homework and be cautious of who you sign with. You don't want to get lost, you know, but.
Yep.
I would say sync pitcher is super helpful. They're who we as music supervisors work with a lot. And, you know, we trust them. We don't have to, no shade, but we don't have to deal with, you know, hundreds of individual artists hitting us up, because it's just so hard to, you know, give our time to everybody. Yes, even as much as we want to.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And some people call sync pitchers sync agents or sync licensing companies or something like that. And we've had a bunch of sync agents on the show that kind of talk about that process. And it's nice to hear from your perspective that you do like working with sync agents, because a lot of sync agents represent indie artists, and they're considered, these sync agents can be considered, you know, one stops, which means that you as a supervisor only need to make one stop around town and clear it with the sync agent because they've already cleared all the rights for you. Whereas in our examples before, where you had to go figure out who owns the rights to the master, then figure out who all the songwriters are, and you have to talk to all their publishers. And so sync agents can kind of help streamline that process. And they've done all that work by the time they pitch you a song, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is super helpful. You know, if we're in a time crunch, having a one stop. So that, I mean, I guess that's the other thing that I would recommend for artists is making sure all of your stuff is buttoned up. Like you've got your splits figured out. You've got your song registrations cleaned up. Like, you know who the writers are and everything's neat. And if you do sign with a pitcher and you have a co-writer or a producer who has a share of the writer's share, like that they're not going to inhibit the, you know, the approval process for getting your music placed. Because if I know, you know, if it's difficult for me, I'm going to have to move on to the next thing if I don't have time to dig into this. And then you lose out on, you know, exposure and money.
That's a really great point to just have everything ready to go before you send out a song for consideration to you or to any music supervisor.
It's a hot look.
So yeah, that's great. You mentioned turnaround and time crunch. Can you kind of talk a little bit about for TV shows, or maybe let's just use, you know, Life and Beth. As an example, from when you kind of come in to the process for an episode or something like that, what is the time frame between, you know, submitting your bin to needing to clear the songs to when the episode airs? Or I guess it doesn't air these days if it's on Hulu. Drops? Or I don't know what they call it these days. right.
You know, I think the total process may be like a month between episodes, or a month and a half between when that process gets started. Sometimes it's less time than that. Once things are kind of temped in and we think a song might land somewhere, we start clearance early just to be cautious. But once we get rough cuts of an episode in particular, then we usually do spotting sessions where we all kind of watch the episode together, discuss the music, and if there's any notes, if we need to swap things, like what's working for licensed music, what's not working for score, like, you know, things like that. And we usually do like a couple rounds of those. So we might do another round of those before everything goes into the mix, or when things are in the mix, that's like the final spotting session. And that's like sound mix for, you know, all the little tweaks, sound design and music. That's like the intense crunch time. So if people decide they don't like something creatively towards the end of that process, that's really when we've got to turn things around quickly, creatively and clearance wise. So if we're dealing with a one stop or like a song that's an easy clear, where we have limited parties, we know that it'll clear within our budget, like we're going to reach out to those resources and tap them to help us, because we need the help.
sure. So once a song is cleared and is placed and the episode's live, who actually pays the artist or the label or the publisher or the sync agent for the sync fee?
That would come from the production company or the studio. I wish I could pay artists, but usually like the production company or studio handles the licensing and payment process. Yeah.
Cool. And I guess changing gears a little bit, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that you're a freelancer. I'm curious about how that works and who hires you, and what does that mean to be a freelancer as a music supervisor on projects like this?
It's kind of like being, you know, a writer or director or showrunner. It's pretty much the same. You kind of bounce around from project to project. It's, you know, per usual, everything's relationship based. So a music department at a studio would hire someone like me, or if I have a pre-existing relationship with a director or another producer, sometimes they'll just roll you onto their next project, or you know, they usually like to keep the same teams. So it can be challenging for people like me to break in when everybody kind of keeps their little pods as they move on through projects. But you know, and then other times it's a producer that's hitting me up, or a director. And then they'll bring me into the studio project. So it kind of varies a bit.
Yeah, and there are challenges. And we had Madonna Wade Reed on the show as well.
Oh, nice.
talking about you know, when music supervisors were attempting to unionize and attempting to be considered employees, like how producers or directors are, because for most shows and most film productions, nearly everyone who works on the production is a W-2 employee, except for a music supervisor who's a freelancer, like a 1099 freelancer. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. So you don't have a lot of the rights and a lot of the protections that everybody else on the production does. And I know that's an ongoing battle, and I know it's up and down, but so, you know, because yes, Hollywood is a seemingly like a freelancer kind of industry, whereas shows start and finish. And that was, you know, a big thing that was part of the writer's strike last year. You know, seasons used to be 27 episodes long, and now they're like 7 episodes long sometimes, or 10. And so you're constantly having to hop around for, you know, from job to job to job. And, you know, I guess from your perspective as a music supervisor, or the people listening to this who want to be music supervisors, what would you tell them as to how they can kind of break in? How could somebody who wants to do what you do become a music supervisor?
I would say, depending on what stage you're at, if you're in college, make friends with the people in your film school or people who are making those projects, you know, because hopefully you can go places together. You can work together. You can learn together. I wish I would have done that when I was in college, but I went to college for something completely different.
What'd you go to college for?
Journalism.
Ah, yeah. Okay.
It was like music history related, but still, you know.
There you go. Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. On the periphery. I would say also try to find a mentor. Like, who's supervising the shows that you like? You know, most of the time people are willing to mentor you, or at least meet with you to give you some advice. There's so many resources available now to learn about supervision, to find out who the key players are, even, you know, mid-level soups, lower level soups. Like, people love talking about themselves. If you reach out to them, I feel like you'll at least get some kind of a response, you know? Especially if you show that you're doing the work to learn, or that you're eager to learn. I would say mentorship is key. If you can find an internship, it's, you know, it's not a super glamorous, well-paying job, as, you know, as much as people think that it is. I feel like 80% of it's paperwork and being hyper organized.
Sure.
Managing expectations and being prepared for a lot of boring aspects of a job, but it's still really cool.
That's great advice, and that's super helpful. And I know the people listening to this really appreciate that. I'm a systems nut. I'm curious, when you say be super organized, what are some of the tools that you use to help keep you organized?
I mean, Excel and Google Docs, those are like your best friends. You know, we have to we have to create project charts usually for everything anyways that track the various stages of music clearance or music licensing. And those can be really intense with a lot of data and information. And you have to usually do variations of those for different parts of the production and post teams. You have to collect a lot of assets like information for the end credits, information for the music cue sheet, high-res music files, all kinds of things, but also organizing like your music library, which is almost impossible. I use Disco.
Cool. Yeah, that's kind of become the industry standard, Disco these days. So that's great. Yeah, Disco, for people listening that don't know, it was designed by music supervisors, created by music supervisors, and is kind of the de facto industry standard of what everyone in sync licensing these days is using, from the agents, the publishing companies, to music supervisors and everything like that. So that makes sense. Cool.
Yeah. Also, I would suggest if you're able to, as an artist, to have a Disco account, and you can make an artist page there. It can look really pretty. You can include all your metadata there and your high-res files. It's so easy to send us a link, and then we can just automatically ingest that into our Disco. It's seamless. It's how a lot of us send out playlists. So that's like a step above if you're able to do that.
Awesome. No, that's great advice. Yeah, very cool. Well, right on. Well, Brittany, this has been so informative and illuminating, and I know everyone listening to this really appreciates all of the wisdom that you bring in the transparency into kind of this elusive world of sync licensing. It's so fascinating. I have one final question that I ask everyone who comes on the show, and that is, what does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
Oh, man. I guess for me, it means being able to put music together to media that makes people feel something, and it sticks with somebody. You know, there's like nothing better than having a musical moment that creates that like nostalgia in your head, where every time you hear that song or that track or even that score, you're like, oh shit, I've got chills right now. And I'm transported into that place. You're like, why am I crying now? Because it reminded me of that emotion in that scene, you know? So if there's moments where I'm able to do that in my career, that's super fulfilling. And if I'm able to like expose the world to diverse artists and, you know, people they likely would have never heard, that's always a plus. Yeah, that's my long answer.
Brittany, that's perfect. Brittany DJ, thank you so much. That was great.
Yeah, thank you.
Today's episode was edited by Ari Davids, with music by Brassroots District, and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. And once again, quick shout out to my partner, BandZoogle. You can design any website on BandZoogle, get 15% off and a 30-day free trial by using the code ARI. That's BandZoogle.com. Use the promo code ARI. All right.